across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
From Victoria Square to cyclists to school uniforms, all coming up on The Nolan Show this morning, this Friday morning, the 13th of December. It's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas, and I can't sing. Hope you enjoy today's programme. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Thank you for joining us today. It's 6 minutes past nine, The Nolan Show from the BBC. So, the residents of Victoria Square Apartments have secured a significant legal victory in their pursuit of compensation. You may remember earlier this year we heard from those residents who had bought apartments in Victoria Square but had been unable to go into them since April 2019, when all residents were told to get out, move out, following an assessment of a structural column. Their previous claim was struck out in March 24, as under the law at that time, claims had to be made within 6 years of a building being completed, unlike the 30-year time frame that was available in England and Wales. So ministers and politicians all got involved in this, and there's a new law that brought Northern Ireland into line with England and Wales, and it came into effect in September. So in court on Thursday, yesterday, appeal judges agreed to make an order for the claims to be sent back for further determination. In other words, they thought they couldn't get their legal case in front of a judge, and they can. So let's remind ourselves about some of what these residents have been saying. Here's Patrick McCaig.
It gave me so much joy when I bought that apartment. I thought, you used my savings to buy it outright. I was so pleased. I was so happy. And then I was totally, absolutely traumatised with the fact that I had to leave. And of course, I haven't been happy since. I haven't been happy since I left there, because I've been waiting and waiting. It's like being in limbo. You know, I'm waiting, just hoping that at the end of 5 years, surely something will be done.
Denise has cancer and wants back into her home.
I will never live in my home again. And I will probably die in somebody else's, and it's not my fault.
You must be tired with all of this.
I'm exhausted from it. My heart hurts. My hernia is making the biggest noise ever. My head hurts. I wake up in the morning and I have to think, where am I? I come out of a hospital appointment and I think, how do I go home?
I want to say thank you for trusting me with this story.
Thank you.
And I really mean that.
Do you know what? I could have cried over this. I have had to put the ice in my veins, and all I want is that point of knowing that we can go to court and have this so that all the documentation and all the background work that we've done, we can mark their homework.
Thank you so much, Denise.
You know, death will take everything, but it's not going to steal my story, and I think it was important now to tell it. But now, after this, I'm going to lie for an hour in a scanner on Tuesday and have a nice little sleep. Everything I valued has been taken from me, from no fault of my own. It's harmed my inner self. It is affecting my health by thinking about it. I have now got to regroup and think how I move forward. You are part of this moving forward, and it's almost like passing a baton to you and saying, please move this forward as much as you can.
And he told me about the impact it was having on his parents, who were having to turn to him for help.
It's just this grave injustice. And, you know, as you say, the last week, there's been a lot of movement. There's been a lot of chat. And my head is still trying to catch up with the details. But I do feel the wheels are turning. And that massive cloud of injustice that surrounds this is starting to clear fractionally. But it's welcome.
What have your parents said to you?
Well, mum and dad, at the start, about 2 weeks ago, I got a shell shock because my mom said that as a family, we face financial ruin. And that's terrifying. There's nothing else I can really say to that. And they're pensioners.
I know.
That's scary.
Obviously, I meant Andy's parents had to help him. Patrick McCaig is back with us this morning. Morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Stephen, and thank you once again, you and your team, for having me back on the radio to just give me a little bit of space to tell my story again.
Well, no, I was going to say, first of all, you don't need to thank us, but secondly, this is brilliant news for you, isn't it? Just sum up what this means to you.
First of all, I want to put people in the picture again about the fact that if you hadn't have done all that you've done on the Radio Ulster and the Nolan Show and got all the MLAs and got all those things to change the law so it would be in line with the UK for 30 years limitation, why were we in court at all? I didn't even know about 6 years limitation. Why were we taken to court knowing that would cost such a lot, the cost alone to go on court, to have the judge struck it out? It's just incredible, really. And more or less, at that time, if it hadn't been for all your team and for all your the BBC and the UTV and the radio, if it hadn't been for all of you, we would still be left in limbo. We would not be able to see any real positive things ahead. But now coming back to what your question you asked me, there is now hope for us. It's almost like turning the clocks back. It was struck out in March, and so we had no right then to appeal. But we have a right to appeal now because of the 30-year limitation. And so now we're back in the picture again. And, I mean, to have companies that actually constructed the building and fitted out the building to vehemently deny liability is just incredible. I really can't believe that is possible. Not one column, but several columns apparently were fractured.
Well, obviously they have their position, and it'll be for a court to decide what the merit is for each of the different positions. That company is entitled to deny liability, but the whole point of this story is that you couldn't get a court to hear your case and to determine who's right and who has liability, and now you can. It's one positive step for you in that you're going to court, but the fight's not over, and you're going to have to fight hard, and you're going to have to presumably find and spend a lot more money now for this appeal.
Yes, but we are trusting in the judicial system that, you know, everything will, when they hear whatever the barristers, all they have to say, I mean, they have the appeal barristers, of course, for the defendants, and then they also have for the claimants as well. We have our barristers, and they put the case before the judge. And I think the judge, in all honesty, will definitely come out with a positive result so that we will get compensated, because this is a terrible injustice to all the apartment owners. And that building, 91 apartments to be empty all this time. It's almost 6 years in February when we have been told to get out of the building. And, I mean, it's just not possible. It's beyond my comprehension to think that this could be allowed to carry on for so long. And I think the judge said something about that this case has been going on too long and we need to get it more or less. This is not her words, but and more or less get it sorted as soon as possible.
And you're still out of your out of your home, aren't you?
Yes.
You can't get back in. So where are you all living?
Well, I'm unfortunately with the help of my family, and I'm in an apartment in the Oval. That's where I am now. But what about the other people that couldn't afford or didn't have family or didn't have finances to support them? And they had to go back to living with their parents. And some of them, as I said to you in previous radio show, that a lot of people could not afford the mortgage. They're just paying the interest on the mortgage. So therefore, I'm fortunate really myself personally, but I want to speak for everybody that's involved in those apartments, the owners of those apartments. Well, I want to speak for all of them. I want justice to be done. And I mean, I hope and pray for justice to be done for the people. And it's so important, really, for an iconic building like that. Imagine to be left empty all these years.
Well,
absolutely.
The good thing is we're going to actually now get the nitty-gritty out into the public domain. That's what that court case will do. Unless, of course, there's a settlement beforehand. And I'll be very, very interested to see if this court case ever actually, if this appeal, now that you can appeal it, I'd be interested to see if that case ever does go ahead or whether there will be some type of settlement. I have no knowledge or inside information, but it's just sometimes when court cases are happening, sometimes there's a settlement, sometimes they're not. You've got to fight it in court. Let's see. Denise, who we heard a clip of there, who, as you know, also has an apartment and has been closely on the Nolan show, as well as with Buckler on Good Morning Ulster. She sent me a wee message yesterday. And she says, thanks to you and Buckler, she actually calls him Chris, who've got us our day in court. And she said, Denise has terminal cancer. And Denise said, if I am no longer alive, my solicitor has permission to use our interview on the Nolan Show as an impact statement. So
there, wonderful.
So there are people clearly with all different issues, problems in their lives, and they want their homes back, or they want compensation so that they can have a forever home for whatever time we all have on this earth. So
absolutely, 100%. I mean, like, all we want is justice. I mean, like, fairness. I mean, like, this was something that we never could never possibly comprehend happening when you bought and put all the money into an apartment in the city centre. So so convenient to the city centre that this type of thing could happen and carry on for all these years. It's really amazing, absolutely amazing. And thanks, I really do, I'm so grateful myself personally to all the MLAs who actually done something about it and really rushed it all through to get the royal assent on the 30 years. And that, I thought that was absolutely brilliant, really.
Okay. Patrick, we are obviously going to stay very, very close to this story and to your response to it. So let's see where we get to, Patrick. And thank you in the meantime. And you have a nice Christmas.
So I wish you and all your team really happy and blessed Christmas time.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you. Good morning. So, of course, we'll stay across that court case. If it goes ahead, let's see. 03030805555. Next, 363 people crossed the cordon. What the Department of Infrastructure have done is they haven't measured peak time traffic at night time in terms of cyclists. They've no data around it whatsoever, which is a question in itself. But we've been asking, as you know, for the cycling figures, these cycle lanes and cyclists. How many cyclists are there actually on the roads when we're having a discussion about congestion and people are seeing cycle lanes and cyclists being accommodated? Well, what we now know is that of the DFI survey, which they did between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning for 2023, we know that out of a travelling population into Belfast of 36,000, just 363 were cyclists. So it's 1% were cyclists. Meg Hoyt from the Belfast Cycle Campaign. Morning to you, Meg.
Good morning, Stephen.
So you can look at this one or two ways. You can say it's only 363, so we need to expand the cycle lanes to get the number of cyclists up. Or when people look at these cycle lanes and cyclists, we can say you've been given far too much priority, far too much talking space for just 360 of you travelling in the mornings at between 8 and 9 in the Belfast.
Yeah. So can you guess which one I'm going to advocate for?
I can.
Okay. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The numbers are low. And the reason for that is we don't have a functioning cycle network. So as I said the other day, we need to expand and connect the cycle lanes to make more journeys by bike possible.
Or, no matter what you do with these cycle lanes, it's not going to go up very much. Or, with all of the hills and the rain and the wind and the weather we have, we're never going to get loads of people onto bikes. And when people are sitting in their car or indeed their bus in the mornings, seeing these cycle lanes, there's a cycle lane in the Dublin Road. For how many people? If there's 360 in total between 8 and 9, how many of them are on the Dublin Road? And there's a dedicated cycle lane. How many? 10?
Yeah, but Stephen, there's really good evidence to show that cities...
I don't know that it's 10, but I don't know how many it would be.
There's really good evidence to show that cities that invest in their cycling infrastructure see a rapid change when it is safe and connected. So cities like Paris have done amazing things in the last 4 years. Even Dublin has started to connect and protect its cycle lanes and has seen improvements. The one more lane will fix the congestion situation is just a non-starter. It won't fix the congestion situation. We know there are too many cars going into Belfast and we have to invest in alternatives. So I see these figures as a pretty damning indictment on DFI's current cycle network. And I would see these as a baseline and I would like to see them go up.
How much invested in this is the Department of Infrastructure if they aren't even asking the question how many cyclists are using the lanes at night time in peak time traffic when we're all trying to get home? They've literally said to us they do not count the number of people leaving Belfast.
I agree. I think DFI needs to do a lot more. There could be a lot done here to monitor which cycle lanes are working, how well they're working, and collecting data is a place to start. I agree.
Now, these are only in the city centre. The reason we're looking at this, obviously, is all the talk, all the debate there has been around the city centre. Some people might have thought that the department, having put these cycle lanes in place, would have been able to come back with robust data, with all types of investigations and experts feeding in to data, analysis of how many cyclists are in each of the individual lanes. No, they don't even measure it at night time.
Yeah, well, I think that's a question for DFI. And I would like to see those figures as well. And I would like to see them concertedly try to improve those figures. You know, to see it as a challenge. We want to see an improvement, more people cycling when the lanes are safe and connected.
Now, I know Newton Emerson's a cyclist, so no doubt he'll be giving me a kick in this morning. Good morning, Newton.
Good morning.
A proverbial kick in, obviously. 360 odd people in peak, 8 to 9, travelling into Belfast. What's that tell you?
Well, I'm not surprised at all, because as far as I'm aware, and I think Meg would know these figures exactly, there are 2 miles of real cycle lanes in central Belfast, and that figure hasn't changed in years. I know that you're sitting in traffic beside one or two of these occasional short stretches of lanes fuming because you think it's the fault of a cyclist that you're stuck there.
No, I've never said that, mate. But carry on.
Well, I mean, or you're pandering to people that feel that way, but really that's not justified. It's a little bit irresponsible, frankly, as well. These tiny stretches of bike lane are completely disconnected, blocked with cars. They can't be in parking in a lot of them can't be enforced because DFI won't pass the simple rubber stamp little legislative orders that make them enforceable. That's a major problem.
Sorry, what would they do? Tell me about that.
When you build a stretch off road, cycle path, bus lane, even a new pavement, you have to redesignate that in law. And that's not, you don't have to pass a law, it's dormant. You use a thing called a legislative order. You just rubber stamp them. And DFI passes hundreds of them every month. But for some reason, it refuses to make pavements, roads, bike lanes, bus lanes in large stretches of the city centre legally enforceable, which is why they're blocked with cars. So even when on these short stretches of cycle lane they do build, you can just park a car in most of them. And as soon as people figure that out, they do that. That happens in bus lanes as well and on pavements. That's a far more serious obstruction to traffic in Belfast than a few cyclists in front of a car.
So, Newton, is there any point in having the cycle lanes unless they're continuous? Is there any point of having these patches? Because it's clearly not incentivising a lot of people to get on their bike.
That's exactly right. It's obviously worth doing if it is a bit-by-bit approach to building up a network. But the fact that zero progress has been made indicates that DfI just has no interest in doing this at all. I honestly don't know what they think they're playing at. They seem to spend more money and effort putting out daft videos and social media accounts promoting cycling than putting, you know, the slightest effort into it. It's just bizarre. It's a box-ticking exercise. And your point that you made at the start of this item about our weather, our hills, and the improbability of cycling ever being a serious mode of transport in Belfast. Well, the look at the places where it is a major form of transport, Holland, Denmark, they have worse weather than we do. Obviously, they don't have worse hills, but most of Belfast is flat in the middle. And yet, in spending money, investing money, not a major amount of money, but investing money in joined up lanes, cycle lanes, has caused cycling to become the solution to their transport problems. It doesn't take cars off the road. Cities in those countries, most people have cars still. They're able to park them outside their houses. They can use them when they need to use them. But they have the option to use their bike, and that keeps the roads much clearer as well for cars.
How much does safety play a part in these numbers being so low of the number of people, Meg, actually using bikes coming into Belfast? 363 people. That is small, Meg. That is tiny, isn't it? Out of a travelling population of 36,000. Is it because it's not deemed to be safe?
Well, yeah. Cyclists, as Newton has said, are not being enabled to cycle around. I know many people who would like to cycle, but just can't figure out a safe route to where they want to go. You know, school runs could be transformed if it was safe to cycle your children to school. Think about all the traffic around schools, individual private cars dropping off their children. You know, in the Netherlands, teenagers are the number one, the highest proportion of cyclists. If you build safe, connected cycle infrastructure, you absolutely change the way people get around the city.
And Newton, what type of reaction would there be if more roads for motorists was taken by bus lanes and now cycle lanes? If more of it was taken away, would there be an overwhelming support for it?
Well, I mean, I want to make the point again that using this clash of road users as a form of entertainment is irresponsible and genuinely puts people in harm's way, especially on a lifetime radio programme. And I think more editorial consideration should be done to that.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, I do know what you're talking about. How is it entertainment, people feeding in to a discussion about this?
I think that you're presenting a clash between people that doesn't exist. That is just considered to be
a bit
amusing. And if you just let me finish here, there's nowhere in Belfast where there's sufficient cycling infrastructure to get in the way of cars. That's not what's causing the traffic in the city, and it shouldn't be presented.
So are you saying that you do not think that there is frustration from some motorists about bus lanes and about cycle lanes, and indeed frustration from cyclists that they don't have enough lanes? It is a clash, isn't it? It's a clash of who's using what and people fighting for what they want to use, is it not?
There is one cycle lane in Belfast, one of the Dublin roads that you mentioned, a few hundred yards, where road space has been taken from cars for a bike lane, for a short stretch of bike lane.
But what,
and that as far as I'm aware, every other stretch of bike lane in the city is pavement or off-road or isn't in
the
way.
Excuse me,
Stephen. I mean, I think this is really quite serious. And I think that you should be very clear that there is currently nowhere in Belfast where cyclists are cycle lanes. or obstructing cars.
But what is the point of a small stretch of that cycle lane on the likes of the Dublin Road? Do you either do it properly or don't do it at all? What is the point of it?
The point of it is that it's part of a connected route.
It's what? Runs,
it's part of it's to be part of a fully connected route that runs from the city centre to the university.
But it's not fully connected, right?
Well, it's not, because they haven't been able to build it all in one go. They have built several stretches of it. It's just disconnected in several places. So you're asking, is there any point in having disconnected stretches of cycle lane? Not if that's a permanent situation. It is part of a project to build up these networks, and DFI is advancing that project. Then yes, there is. But yes, there's no point in doing it if you're going to do a half job and leave it.
And Meg, have DFI got any timetable to do it?
Yes, but they're behind on that timetable. So there's an action plan that was published in 2022 to implement the Belfast Cycle Network, a plan that was developed, I think, 10 years ago. And I think there's 16 phase one projects. And I can tell you that Limestone Road is a phase one project, and that was supposed to begin 4 years ago. So DFI really need to pick up the pace on this, because as Newton has pointed out, it is a critical safety issue for people who cycle around the city. This is not a joke. This is something that needs to happen, and it needs to happen at pace.
But so they're 4 years late with that stretch of road. Why?
Yep. Well, that's a question for DFI. I can't answer that. I would have liked to have seen it in 2021. It's a road I use every day.
But is it down? Well, you're saying you don't know. Is it down to money? Is it down to they don't have the funding, or what?
Again, this is a question for DFI. There's consultation processes that get in the way. But I don't know if it's a funding issue. It was due to start in 2021, and we're still waiting.
Meg, can I jump in there? I think that that was something to do with concerns by residents about their parking, and that is a real issue. From what I know of that road, there's enough space for certainly every resident to park, although they might all have to do it down one side of the road. I think that has to be addressed. But what happened is that DFI just simply chickened out of it. I think that seems to be what happened.
Okay, Newton, thank you. Meg, thank you. I know you need to go. 030-30-80-55-55. We'll get your reaction to this after the news. Here we find ourselves talking about traffic again this morning. Cyclists is absolutely an issue that you want to talk about this morning. 030-30-80-55-55 is our number. Sanjay, you're talking about the traffic disruption, the general traffic disruption on your business in Belfast City Centre. Morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
So what's happening to you, Sanjay?
Well, basically, we are a dry cleaning business in the city centre. We do a lot of deliveries to hotels every day, a couple of times a day. It's been very difficult to get there to be dropped off within a certain time for their hotel staff and guests. So it's having an impact on our business.
Sanjay, let me come back to you, and we'll just see if we can get your phone a little bit better. I'm finding it hard to hear you a little bit. So we'll come back to you in a second. Robert in Belfast. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, why don't you take a leaf out of Frank Mitchell's book? Frank Mitchell cycles in on his electric bike into U105 from Des Murray every morning of the week.
Can you call it cycling if you're on an electric bike?
Well, let's put it this way.
It's riding, isn't it? You're riding. You're not cycling, you're riding.
It is, Mr. Nolan, but you can't cycle and you can let the electric do whatever. If you're going up a hill or something, you can put it on the electric. But like you, Stephen, you could drive from the Hay Island down to Dundalen there to Park and Ride and you could fold up an electric bike, put it in the boot and get it out and cycle in from Dundalen down to the BBC.
And get soaked.
Mr. Mistle,
on the way in when it's raining. Maybe that's refreshing.
You can put a good coat and a good hat on, Stephen. You can work away there. All joking aside, Stephen, the cycle lanes, some of them cycle lanes are too wide. That causes a problem. And our money just eat bikes is out on the move every day. There seems to be a lot of them just eat bikes promoted by the city council.
What do you mean?
Have you never seen the Just Eat Bikes? All the racks with all the bikes around the greater Belfast area.
People they just them. Eat, just eat, is what you're saying, yeah, to deliver food.
No. They're advertising Just Eat. Some of them guys are doing that, working for Just Eat. They're handing them bikes, city council bikes. Yeah. Have you never seen them all around the racks? Go to Stranmillers car park. They're all taken up. People park their cars in Stranmillers car park.
Do you you're asking why I'm not getting on a bike to get into work. Do you?
Stephen, I've cycled all my life, to be honest with you.
Have you?
I have, yeah. I've cycled, yes.
So what happened? So practical issue, right? Genuine question. So let's say it's pelting down with rain, okay? And you get into work soaked. Like, what do? You bring a change of clothes?
Yeah.
Is that what cyclists do?
Well, probably if they don't, they should do.
But is that what you? I genuinely don't know. Do they bring a change of clothes and a backpack on their bike, or what do? You can't sit, 9 to 5 soaked, can you?
But Stephen, have you never seen people with a big sort of like waterproof raincoat cycling? You know, when's the last time you had a bit of rain, Stephen? Yeah, it's nice and dry now to cycle. To be honest, I'm a great advocate of people cycling in the city. It's good for the environment and everything. But the only thing I've against is that one on Dublin Road. It's too wide. You can have cycle lanes, and there's a lot of pavement.
Well, it's probably wide for safety, isn't it? I don't know how wide it is or it isn't. But safety, as Meg and Newton were pointing out, it's really important.
To be honest with you, I've seen it. I'm out in the roads every day. There's bad, bad drivers out there. And if you're driving up a road, Stephen, and you see a cyclist ahead of you, what do? You indicate to get out on the other lane past the cyclist. There's motorists, Stephen. They're dangerous. There's motorists out there, dangerous. Have to call a spade a spade. And they drive nearly right up into the back of the pushbikes, people on pushbikes. And decide to move out. You know, they're not reading the road, and there's a few explanations why they're not using the roads. It's probably what I'm on now, but I never used.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Phones. I think we've got Sanjay's line fixed. This is about the wider congestion in Belfast city centre and how some businesses around it are being affected. Sanjay, morning again.
Good morning, Steve.
That's better. So tell us about what business you have and how you're being affected.
We have a dry cleaning and laundry business in the city centre of Queen Street. So we do a lot of hotel work and corporate work for lovely offices and hospitality. So we do a lot of deliveries back and forth. And they do require a high-end service and a service that has to be done within a certain time. But this is proving quite difficult now with the congestion in the city centre and has been for the last 4 weeks or so.
So tell me what you've been experiencing.
Basically, we're coming out towards Green Victoria Street. I was sitting, normally it would take me around the 40-minute mark to do a certain stop within the hotel on Howard Street, Green Victoria Street, and Bedford Street. But it took me an hour and a half the last time to the point I'm thinking, this can't be sustainable, because I still then have to get back to work to process other orders for the same day or the following day. So it's really, having to stay behind to catch up. Customers can't get in within time. I'm getting calls on a daily basis asking me if I could hang on a few more moments, maybe half an hour, to get in to pick up whatever they need or make some sort of arrangement that they get their goods. So not just myself, it's having an impact. It's like our customers coming into the city. And I'm probably speaking for a lot of businesses within the city centre. This is what we are faced with. All since they've closed, these 2 or 3 streets, Great Victoria Street, you can't turn left from Howard Street, Grosvenor Road, there's no Boyne Bridge anymore, and it has a massive impact on the whole city centre.
Well, they're trying to tell you, look, let's see where we're at in January. They're trying to associate at least some of this congestion with Christmas.
Look, it's not, this will be an issue that will carry on after Christmas and all next year. If these streets are closed to normal traffic, it'll continue. These issues won't go away. If anything, if it alleviates the problem, it'll be because people will not be coming back into the city. They've been burnt once, they don't want to get caught again, and they'll stay out of the city centre. They'll not even get the public transport, but public transport is, to be honest, a joke at the moment. My wife, we live in Temple Patrick. She gets the airport bus from Temple Patrick into the city centre, and on two occasions, the bus didn't turn up. So then she had to get back into her car to try and make the appointment on Lisburn Road, and she couldn't get the appointment because of the traffic within the city. So unless they have their foundation done and you know, correctly laid out for people to use the service, it's not going to work.
And meanwhile, you're trying to keep a roof over your head, employing people, trying to keep a... It's hard enough to keep a business going these days with the rise in costs.
I have three people that live outside of Belfast, Antrim, North Belfast and Glengormley. And every other day I'm getting a text message from them, the bus is late, the bus hasn't arrived, or we're on the motorway, but there's delays. And it's fine. You know, I could take that. They'll come in. I don't cut the hours. But how long can this keep going for? So they may be coming in around half an hour late, 40 minutes late or whatever. But you can't keep doing it.
Have you not seen the ads that TransLink are pumping out telling you that you're travelling in bliss?
Oh, I've been listening to your programme this week about it. And the day I was listening, I was effing and blaming at the radio. I'm thinking, these guys are on a different planet. They're sitting behind a desk, a little pencil and a little wee notebook, you know, thinking this is the way Belfast should go. We are not like any other European city. We do not have a massive amount of population that live in the city centre. We have students. But you need inner city living for this to work.
TransLink are telling you that they will take the stress out of your day. And it will be hassle free if you get on a bus. Now, surely if more and more of us get on buses, it will be hassle-free because there'll be fewer cars and therefore public transport will have a significant positive impact on the congestion in our city.
About a mile, half a mile outside of Belfast City Centre, it's all green fields. We all live out in the countryside. We are not like Manchester, Birmingham, that has millions of people of population. Even Dublin has a high population. Belfast doesn't have that. And so it's not practical for a lot of people to use public transport, but they don't have a bus coming outside their door every half an hour. They may have to walk, you know, a considerable length of time before they get a bus, and that too might be only one service, two services a day. So it's not going to work here unless there's a massive inner city living in the future, perhaps, yes, with a number of apartments, etc. But at the moment, no. And by that time, if they keep doing this, there'll be no independence left in the city centre. There'll be nothing left. And people will just go to out-of-town centres that they have been doing over the last few decades. So there's always an issue with Belfast whenever it comes to, you know, traffic and parking and traffic wardens, etc. But we try to get over these hurdles. But this is a massive, big hurdle that nobody wants to be faced with when they're driving into the town.
John O'Dowd has an office in town. The actual minister who's asking more and more of us to take public transport, to consider taking it when we're travelling into town. When we asked John O'Dowd how often he gets the bus into his office in town, he won't tell us. And his department has said he uses public transport when he can, but they won't tell us. So he says he travels into that office 1.5 days a week, so between 1 and 2 days a week. But he won't tell any of you. While he's asking you to take a bus, he won't tell you if he ever takes a bus himself into that office in town.
Yeah, well, that's expected. That answer was expected, because there's no way he would be on the bus. He may be on the bus now because the spotlight's on him, but he wouldn't be on the bus prior to this. He would be coming in his car like everybody else. And to have people say, well, they should be working from home one day a week to alleviate the congestion. For the last 3 years, the government and corporate have been trying to get people back into the offices. And then they're having to turn around and do a U-turn and say, work from home for another day a week. That's just scandalous. Meanwhile, everybody else who has to work in the hospitality, retail, etc., they're twiddling their thumbs because there'll be nobody in the city centre.
But why don't you embrace the notion of public transport? Now, look, John O'Dowd's people say he's a minister and there's the confidential papers and all of that. So maybe that's why he's not on the bus. I don't know. And he takes public transport when he can. I don't know when that is. But they're certainly not getting into the detail of it, Sanjay. But why not embrace the notion of more and more of us, even if the instinct is we prefer our car, to try it?
It would work over time. but the infrastructure has to be in place. The services have to be better, have to be more regular, they have to be cleaner. It's not ticking those boxes at the moment. And until it does, it won't work, and people will still continue. As I say, if someone has a car, they're leaving their kids to school, they come in to work, then on the way home they pick up their kids from school again. But, you know, we don't live, we don't have the schools in the city centre, we don't have the millions of people of population. We don't have that here in Belfast. So it can't work until Belfast city centre grows, where there are more and more people living there and there are more services within the city, that these public transport systems will work. You know, until then, it's not going to work. But it's a very, very slow process. And I do welcome all the public transport, but only whenever the time is right. Meanwhile, you can't just keep hammering nails in the coffin to the businesses that are trying to succeed and move on. There'd be nothing left. Absolutely nothing left.
Do you think your profit margin has already been hit by what infrastructure have done?
Absolutely. The last 3 to 4 weeks, without a doubt. And productivity at work, obviously, with the employees coming a bit later. I haven't taken anything off their wages, and nor will I, because I'm not that type of person. But if it keeps going on, there's going to have to be some sort of change within the workplace. But yes, it has been hit. And obviously, after Christmas, you get the first quarter of next year, which is quiet right across the board in retail, hospitality. And that's when we'll feel it even more. And by that time, the damage is done. It's very, very hard to get people back into the routine, back into the city centre. We've had that with COVID and various other issues. And we were coming out of that, and Belfast is getting back into where it was before, and then all of a sudden now this has happened.
Well, look, infrastructure, both John O'Dowd, the minister in charge of the department, and the senior people within it, this junction, which seems to be causing at least some of the problem, turning left at Great Victoria Street onto the Grosvenor Road, they say they're reviewing it. What would you say back to them?
They should have thought about this before, when the planning was being done for this Grand Central Station, which is great. I think it's great. Our tourism is flourishing year on year, and I think it's very, very welcoming that this is a big, major part of Belfast. But they could have maybe planned a little bit better, have the pavement slightly wider, have the barriers along the pavement so the traffic can still continue and passengers can still get off out of Grand Central Station and walk up the street. There was no reason to have a no left turn there. Now you're having to do a full detour of nearly a quarter of a mile, half a mile to get onto the M1. So on one hand, they're trying to prevent the cars from coming, but they're creating more emissions within the city by doing so. And it's frustrating for the drivers, and it's not safe either for the road users. You have your cyclists. A lot of these cyclists are just weaving in and out of the traffic with no consent. You know, they don't care what's happening.
The majority of them do now. Come on.
No, some of them do. I see them on a Friday morning coming down through Carrick Hill, and they are brilliant. There's no problem. There's manners within their cycling. But see, a lot of them, it's terrible. They're dangerous. And same for these ones on the scooters. They're on the pavement, and I see them walking, riding past my front of the shop, and they're only inches away from the door. They only take somebody from walking out of my unit straight on the pavement, and they get hit by a cyclist or one of those scooters. Who's responsible for that? There's no insurance. There's nothing at all. There's no high vis. There's no lights on them. So they need educated too as to how to use
the road. That's the motorised scooters you're talking about. Sanjay, thank you very much. I can hear your passion today. I can hear your anger. Let's see what the Department of Infrastructure does. Let's this review about that left turn. How long is the review going to take? And you're saying this is affecting your ability to do business in the city centre. Thank you, Sanjay. Our next story, the outgoing Commissioner for Older People, Eddie Lynch, left his post yesterday after 8 years in the role. He's with us this morning. Morning, Eddie.
Good morning, Stephen.
Sorry for keeping you waiting, Eddie. Had you had enough, or can you only do 2 terms, or why are you going?
No, this is the end of my second term, so I can only do a maximum of 8 years, Stephen. So that's why I'm going now. So it's been a long and a bit of a roller coaster 8 years, lots of big issues, but it's been an absolute privilege to serve in that position.
Why is there no one being lined up to take over from you straight away?
Well, there is a recruitment process underway, Stephen. It's been handled by the executive office, so my office isn't involved in that process. So we would hope that there'd be something announced early in the new year. Certainly it's a question older people have been asking me now for several months about who is replacing me, and I'm sure older people will want to see somebody announced as soon as possible.
But they, and so I get it that obviously it's not your responsibility, it's the executive office, but they knew that you can only do a two-term post. They knew when you were ending, therefore, and they've left older people without a commissioner over the winter, over Christmas period. And who knows when they're going to actually announce someone. Will it be January? Will it be February? Why have they left older people without one? Do you all think that's a fair question?
Well, I think that's a question for the executive office to answer, Stephen. As I say, the process has been ongoing for several months now. I'm not sure exactly where that's at. But certainly it is something that I would like to see happen as quickly as possible. Certainly older people don't want to see a long period of time with no commissioner in place, particularly at this time during the winter, and all the big issues that they're facing. So I'm sure they're trying to expedite that as quickly as possible to get somebody in place.
What's been your biggest frustration in the job?
Well, I suppose, Stephen, I mean, there's been a lot of big issues. I mean, it was frustrating for me that the Assembly was down for quite a sizable part of time in my term. But I suppose, what I have found is that even when you get agreement on change happens very slowly. So whether it's changes to policy, practice, and particularly legislation, that all goes through at a very slow pace. And, one of the big the issues that came out of my term was the Dunmurry Manor investigation. And the number one recommendation of that was new safeguarding legislation. Now, that has been worked on for a number of years now. I understand that it's ready to go. But I want to see that introduced to the Assembly as soon as possible. And there really can't be any more delays to that because we need that legislation. Everyone accepts that we need it to better strengthen the rights of older people and other vulnerable adults. So I want to see that come to the Assembly as a matter of urgency.
And what would change in terms of that legislation that they still haven't got in place yet? Stormont hasn't. How would it protect older people in care homes better?
Well, it would put an onus on people to report things, to act on concerns raised in a much more stronger way. What we found in the investigation was that the legislation in place was outdated, was fragmented. All the authorities told me that they felt that the legislation they were working under had serious flaws with it. And the result of that was that actually people fell between the gaps in it and actually people weren't protected. So when concerns were raised, sometimes those concerns weren't acted upon. So this new legislation will strengthen that, will put onus and accountability on people to report and take action more quickly. And that's better for anyone who's in a vulnerable position.
Yeah, look, I worked a lot on the Dunmurry Manor story, as I'm sure you remember, and you concluded, Eddie, that there was a horrific catalogue of an inhumane and degrading treatment at Dunmurry Manor at the time. And here we are, and they still haven't got the legislation in place to stop it happening in wherever again.
Well, yes, and that was several years ago now, Stephen, and that's the frustration. I understand that it takes time to develop legislation, but I think there are ways of definitely getting it through a lot quicker than we have seen, particularly when it's something so important, in protecting some of the most vulnerable people in our society. So yes, there have been improvements made. I'm glad that a lot of the authorities have worked to follow up on the recommendations from Home Truths. I've seen a lot of good progress made, but we're not there yet. More work is needed. And, we can't be complacent on these issues that really matter to people's lives.
You made 59 recommendations at the time of that report that you did. How many have been implemented?
Well, I wouldn't have an exact number, but I think there's a lot of the big recommendations that have been major steps forward. We have worked very closely with the authorities. We would meet the likes of the RQIA now on a regular basis. We would receive updates against the different recommendations, same with the health department. So certainly we have seen a lot of evidence that there's been a lot more proactive response to issues and concerns raised. Obviously, the biggest one was the new legislation. I'm pleased that that has been put together. Now we just need to see it put to the floor of the Assembly and get it passed so we get it in place so people are better protected.
And Eddie, in terms of the voice that older people have in our community and the difficulties that is in any society when you get older, another is the NHS and access to care and access to care packages if you want to continue to live at home.
Yes, Stephen. I mean, older people unfortunately face a lot of major challenges. And I think when we have a health system under so much pressure, older people are the biggest users of that service. So obviously they are disproportionately affected by that. So, you know, these are all massive issues. But, you know, my call has always been that the ageing population should be a top priority for government here. You know, I've called for it to be included as one of the priorities in the current programme for government. I think if we don't do that, we are missing a major trick here. And actually, we won't start addressing some of the fundamental problems that we face because the demand for these services is going to increase as we age more. But there's many positives about the ageing process as well. Older people continue to contribute so much to society. And that's why, you know, defending things like the bus pass is so important, because the best way to age well is to keep active and independent for as long as possible. So we need more of those policies to support older people, to keep them healthier. And that would be good for the individuals, but it'll also be good for us and the health service, because less people will need access to that.
But when we hear about these waiting times in our hospital and the problems that there is with a growing population and then access to services in the NHS, older people obviously will be being disproportionately affected because they need healthcare more than anyone else.
Exactly. And, you know, we have dealt with so many cases where people have had to wait long periods of time for operations, long periods of time for getting the different domiciliary care packages. That has been the number one issue coming to my office over the last few years. And these are fundamentals that we need to get right because, you know, they might be trotted out as statistics, but behind every statistic is a person and a person's life.
Have you enjoyed the job? And what's next?
I have, Stephen. I mean, it's been a real privilege. You know, it's had its up and downs. It's been tough at times. But, you know, I'm really pleased with what myself and my team have achieved over the last year, 8 years. I'm moving on in the new year to take up the chief executive post with the Law Centre. So that's something that I'm very much looking forward to. And hoping.
What's the Law Centre? The Law Society or what?
No, it's Law Centre Northern Ireland, so it provides a lot of legal support and advice for many groups across Northern Ireland. So that's something they've done fantastic work over the years. I've been well aware of the work that they've done. So I'm looking forward to starting there in the new year.
Well, look, Eddie, you've been on the Nolan Show over the years lots and lots of times, and thank you for that. And we continue to hope to hear from you on the programme, and we wish you all the very best, Eddie, for the future.
Yes, Stephen, and I thank you as well for covering so many of the issues over the last 8 years. The media is a really important part of the Commissioner role, so I do thank you for giving me the platform to raise these issues on behalf of older people.
All the very best, Eddie. Thanks. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us here at the Nolan Show. Significant support for a new law to make all school uniforms affordable in Northern Ireland. Well, of course, there's significant support for that. Who wouldn't want a school uniform to be affordable? But what else does this tell us? Let's speak to our BBC Northern Ireland Education Arts correspondent, Robbie Meredith. Morning to you, Robbie.
Morning, Stephen.
The amount of people who have actually engaged in it tells us a story in itself. The consultation, 7,500 responses is more than normal.
It is more than normal. Look, I'm not an expert in government consultations, Stephen, but that is a big response. And over half of those were for parents. So you had thousands of parents responded to this. Also quite a lot of young people, other organisations, charities, local councils and so on. So yeah, a big response. And as you say, a lot of support for a law to make uniforms affordable, but the devil's going to be in the detail. How do you actually do that by law will be the question that the education minister and civil servants are going to have to wrestle with. I'm told that bill is expected to come before the Assembly next year. No indication of exactly what month, but certainly there is going to be a law to make uniforms affordable. Everybody, schools, parents, everybody will want to know what the detail is, though.
And one of the suggestions from some of the campaigners has been to remove the need for school blazers, ban branded PE kits, enforce a cap on school uniform costs. All of this has been bandied about, my goodness, for decades. It's whether they're actually going to make a decision on it or not.
It has. I mean, you've probably heard from parents, you know, about some of the bugbears they have around uniform. For instance, you can't go to, say, a supermarket and get a pair of white shorts for PE. You have to buy a particular, you know, white shorts of a particular brand, for instance. Even when it comes to school blazers, again, some of those can be quite expensive. You know, there's different uniforms for particular schools. Nobody is against, there were a few voices against uniforms, said it was outdated, but most people support school uniforms. They actually, a lot of parents feel it would be more expensive to have to kit kids out in the latest gear, in their own gear, to send them to school every day. So nobody, there wasn't massive a movement against uniforms or the idea of uniforms themselves. But, you know, branded PE kits do get on people's nerves and make things more expensive. Even, I'm not sure everybody would want to do away with school blazers, but that's often the element of uniform that, that people feel is most pricey. And most parents, when you talk to them, feel that something could be done to tackle the cost of blazers and so on. Should say that there were arguments as well in this consultation that actually branded gear, kind of, you know, gear from certain suppliers that could sometimes be better quality, it could be longer lasting and so on. So in some ways, it's not all about the money, but of course, it's the expensive school uniform that people most often talk about.
Okay, Robbie, thank you. Kathleen O'Hare, former head teacher. Morning, Kathleen.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, parent and school uniform cap campaigner.
Yeah.
Naomi McBurney. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Interesting title there.
Alliance Councillor for Ards and North Down, Naomi. Look, can we start with the branded gear? Because it's something that I've been discussing on radio programmes 30 years since I was in CityMate. Where do you stand on that, Kathleen, as a school principal? The saying to a child, this brand, this logo is so important that, you know, you can't come into school without it. If you want to play sport, for example.
Well, Stephen, a branded uniform is very, very important for a school. No football team would expect their team to come out without wearing their strip. There are a lot of inter-school competitions at the minute, and you know, I know there's a reason for branded kit. Then, is there a need for branded kit outside that? Probably not. But if there is a need for one, there's a need for only one, and not a different one for every single sport. Because if you rack up the price of, you maybe a child is very sporty, playing four sports, wearing four different sports uniform, that's where the real cost
but
of uniform is.
Help me understand why or how you're defending rather than something that is of good quality. It has to be of a specific brand. Why?
Well, I can tell you from experience, not getting something that wasn't branded and made from particular uniform companies. If you know anything about colour, if you can get, there may be 1,000 different colours of navy, for example. So you have to give the lumen number for each item that you are buying. And if you buy that in places that are not specified for your uniform, you photograph all your children for prize giving, it looks like everybody is wearing a completely different uniform. So there is a need to stick to suppliers.
I'm talking about sport here, Kathleen.
Sports uniform, people are going out on kit. Part of sport is about fitness, but it's also about pride. It's about confidence. It's about, you know,
it's about
building self-esteem. So you don't really want them to come out looking like dolly mixtures, you know, onto the. When they're playing with another school that are completely kitted out, how would a child feel? How would you feel yourself if that was you?
How does a child feel when they're being told that what they are wearing, that if they don't have enough money to be specifically looking like the rich child, that they are somehow inferior?
I don't think that's what schools intend to do. And I think a lot of schools have done a lot of work in trying to get cheaper uniforms, and that includes a sports uniform as well. Now, you want a sports uniform that's going to last the whole year, and then it's cost effective. Where if you buy maybe a cheaper sports uniform, it's finished by Halloween. You know, and I've seen that happen with leggings, with tops. They've had to buy another one, so it really wasn't cost effective to buy the cheaper brand.
But isn't it up to, rather than a school principal or a board of governors, isn't it up to the parent of that child that it might suit them? If you take a single mother, a single father, a working class family, and maybe it would actually suit them to buy two sets of the PE kit during a year, because guess what? Cash flow. Because guess what? They might have a heating oil bill that month at the start of the year, and they know they'll have a few more quid in the middle of the year. And schools and boards of governors and people with your thought process, Kathleen, are dictating to parents. And what you're not doing as schools, and then I'll answer. What you're not doing as schools, of course, is you're not taking on the responsibility of buying the kit and giving it to the children. You're not taking that out of your school budget, but you're imposing all of these rules on a parent.
I don't think that's completely fair, Stephen, because boards of governors are made up from parents. The Parent Teacher Association made up with parents. So a lot of parent voice is actually in schools, and indeed pupil voice as well. Many schools do help with school uniforms, particularly those who don't have branded uniform. When they're playing inter-schools competition, they will have a uniform that students can actually wear. So, you know, it is a huge responsibility on schools. But I'm telling you, as a parent, I would still prefer children going to school in a school uniform. And I completely applaud an affordable school uniform. It is a lot cheaper in the end. I went to buy my granddaughter some sports gear recently. I was horrified at the price of it. So let's say when football teams start bringing out really cheap, affordable T-shirts, which children are going to grow out of in 6 months, then we can talk about school uniforms that people wear 185 days of the year.
Naomi?
Gosh, Stephen, I have quite a lot I could contribute on this. I suppose one of the most important issues is that parents are under significant financial pressure to be able to afford these branded PE kits, to be able to afford honours blazers, because they don't want their child to miss out. And I would disagree with Kathleen in that the parent voice is not being heard, nor is the child or the young person's voice, and that is very clear from the huge volume of respondents that replied to this consultation, because people feel so passionate that they need to see change. I have done extensive research with parents and young people, and the majority of them don't feel that they're being heard on this issue, and they are facing significant sanctions, as well as parents then having to get into debt. And it is a major issue, and it really is disappointing to hear that, you know, that something like a school photograph will be ruined because pupils are wearing a different tone of a colour. That really shouldn't be a priority when it comes to a child's education and being accessing sport.
Well, the whole point of a uniform is uniformity. Is it not?
Yes. Yes, but when it comes to a colour tone, or when it comes, you know, it's not necessary to have such multiple branded items and a PE kit that is compulsory, that parents are, you know, experiencing financial duress to pay for it, and indeed the commercial relationships that then see that are, you know, for example, PE teachers then get free kit, and that's on the backs of parents who are paying for it. You know, there absolutely needs to be, that needs to end for sure, and the, you know, bringing in legislation is a welcome move forward, but it's getting, and as Robbie has already said, it's in the details. The legislation is so important here, because England and Wales have both introduced legislation that has not worked, so you know, we do need to get, the minister needs to take that under consideration.
But does your party believe in a school uniform, a consistency in dress in a school or not?
Sorry, I'm talking about this as a parent campaigner. So yes, I absolutely support school uniforms, and would my position is very much that school uniforms are there for they do help families to be able to afford. But at the moment, they're not. The original intention of school uniforms has been blown out of the water, to be quite honest with you, because they've become so expensive, and parents are really struggling to afford them, and children are missing school because they simply can't afford, or they're being sanctioned and not being able to attend things because they can't afford the right pieces of kit, which is really not acceptable.
You mentioned young people's voices being excluded, and that's why we've made sure we've got a young person on the programme today, Ellie Jo Taylor. Good morning to you.
Hi, Harry.
Good morning. I know you're in university now, but you're certainly closer to that age group than Naomi or Kathleen or I. Have you seen pressure in school over uniforms? Have you felt it, Ellie Jo? Not necessarily particularly among your with yourself, but other people.
Absolutely. From my own background, I went to a 60% free school meal, and I was one of the students on free school meals. So, for me, I think it was the uniform grant was maybe £70 around there. And, I think every parent listening knows that the school uniform is not £70. And for us, it was something between summer, you're talking June, July time, where people are probably already struggling, and they have literally so many other priorities going on. But you have things that schools are kind of putting forward. And I know it's not like a common practice in schools that every school would promote, things like branded ties, for example. But some schools are, and that is pricing some teachers, some parents, sorry. And I think, from my own example, you just asked Naomi there, whether she agrees with uniforms. And I think I kind of want to make the point that as a young person, I actually do agree with uniforms. I think they're one of the greatest equalizers we can have in a classroom. I remember speaking to my principal previously because I went to a 60% free school meal. School that she was told that her attendance dropped 50% during non-uniform days because things like branded items, fancy items kind of come under that in their equation.
So look, if there's so much merit in that, Ellie, as you're arguing, why does that not apply to sport then as well?
Yeah, well, I think, to be honest, I couldn't see why it would be applied to sport. I think, I believe the young people should be active. I believe we should be getting them to engage in PE. So why then would we exclude a young person from class because they didn't have the right, kit or PE gear? From my own experience, it was, there is this uniform, but see if you have a white shirt and leggings, perfect, engage in the class. And I think if we're talking about trying to get young people to engage in their education, is that surely not more important than whether they have the school crest on their shirt, things like that. I don't believe that's valid young people. I can't name a young person that GCSEs or A levels have ever improved because they're wearing a crest on their shirt. And I think it is one of them things where the only outcome of it is, one, that rigid uniformity maybe that schools might prioritize, is that beneficial for the young person? Are they maybe being bullied by their peers, or two, is it putting their parents under huge financial pressure? Three, have they been excluded from class if they can't actually afford that? I think there's more downsides to it, and I don't think a rigid, stance to it is beneficial for anybody.
Kathleen?
Ellie is a voice of reason in the midst of this. I have to say, no child should be excluded from PE because they're not wearing the right kit.
They are, though, Kathleen.
That should be happening. And in a lot of schools, that is not happening. The other point you make about 7,500 responses, while that seems huge, for example, there are 10,000 post-primary students in North Belfast. There are 8,000 post-primary students in Derry. So, 7,500 as a representation of the school population, which must be close to 500,000, is not a huge response.
Relatively speaking to government consultations, when they go out for consultation with things, it is high. It is. Of the general population, it's not high, but in terms of how many people usually respond to government consultations, it is high.
Well, it's a lot of people, but I can guarantee you, if you got rid of uniforms, even sports uniforms, your successor in 2-3 decades' time would be having the opposite argument here on radio today. Because to clothe a child, and Ellie makes the point brilliantly, to clothe a child for school without a uniform will actually be a huge divider between the haves and the have-nots, because you'll have the Converse trainers, you'll have the 100-pound trainers, you'll have the Guess shirts, you'll have whatever, and somebody else will be wearing a branded, a non-branded, a no-name brand. So,
which is what they have to do as soon as they come out of school. Which is what, and do we not have to teach children? Because that's how they live when they're
leave school.
Sorry,
you're a lot different when you leave.
No, you're school not.
Than when you go in.
Sorry, after the bell goes at 3:30. I'm not talking about.
Oh no, after the bell goes.
No, but I'm talking. Yes. I'm talking about Kathleen. After the bell goes at 3:30, whatever, these children who are being taught that, look, you've got to have this branded gear when you're in school, they then go home. Their mum and dad can't afford that branded gear. They've got to have the self-esteem and the knowledge that they're as good as anybody else, even if they're wearing a shirt at a fiver rather than 50 quid. Is there not a confused message being given to them?
Well, once they're under the school roof, children should all be treated the same.
What about when they're not under the school roof?
Well, that isn't a responsibility. I mean, that's up to government.
No, I'm not talking about responsibility.
I am not talking about responsibility.
I'm talking about when a young person is growing up and their sense of self-esteem and their sense of value in themselves. How can they be taught when you're in school part of that self-esteem and part of that confidence in yourself is based on you have the same clothing as everybody else. But, you know, the bell goes at 3:30 and all of a sudden you don't.
We're not responsible, and that is a society. That's, the unequal society that we actually live in. But once they're under the school roof, an awful lot can be done to build a child's self-esteem. I've always worked in schools that have between 50% and 75% of the children free school meals. And those schools continue today to build self-esteem of young people, some of them now leaders in our society, and some of them actually leaders of political parties. And they didn't come, they didn't have branded gear outside of school. In fact, their tales outside school were ones that would make you weep. But however, once they were inside school, a lot could be done to actually foster self-esteem, so much so that the children of those people are now back at that school because they valued that school and the values that it instilled.
Hayley in Antrim. Morning, Hayley.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I would say a lot has changed in recent years. I remember when I went to school, the rules were uniform were concerned were a little bit more lax, shall we say. My children attend a grammar school. For games, they need a different kit. For PE, they need a different kit. And they recommend, and I mean recommend highly, that you go to one specific shop for the uniform.
Of course they do, which is against the guidance.
Yeah.
It was actually John O'Dowd, from memory, introduced the guidance when he was Minister for Education. I remember Stanley Stormont talking to John about it, the guidance is that you're not supposed to have one supplier. You're just not.
And the thing is, too, parents don't get a say in what their children wear. You know, the lady was saying that, you know, the Board of Governors, there's only a couple of parent governors, depending on the size of the school. The PTA has nothing to do with what the school decides the uniform to be. So, you know, it really is. It's not a situation that the parents are involved in.
Do you think it needs to change?
I think it should change, yes.
Thank you, Hayley. William and Armagh. Morning, William.
Hello, Stephen. Look, I remember a very powerful interview you done with a lady maybe a year or two back. She was in tears worrying about providing for her children's school uniforms, and she didn't know where she was going to where the money was going to come from. This nonsense about having a school uniform and a brand and to identify one school against another, I think it's down to more snobbery and one-upmanship. What's wrong with just getting into a shop and buying a badge or a label, get the mother to sew it onto the shirt.
Or the father.
Or the father, yeah, of course. Or the father. And for a few pounds, run all these expenses. And the other thing, that lady said, one shop having a monopoly on school uniforms, charging poor people a fortune. You understand? Imagine having some woman having two or three kids at a grammar school the same year. What sort of money is she going to be out? What about six badges? About 15 quid on a thing. We give the people the identity of a...
Well, Kathleen's arguing that you would then have... I don't want to put words in your mouth, Kathleen, but Kathleen's arguing you then would have different colours representing the same team. It'd be difficult to get the same colour if you don't have a consistency of manufacture.
White and black. White and black. There's nothing wrong with that.
Even black has a huge amount, hundreds of different colours of black.
I think that woman is talking utter nonsense.
Kathleen's here.
Utter nonsense. If you're a woman
at home for 35 years, and to be honest, all of those 35 years, school uniform has been there. I've tried the badge thing, buying the badge as well. Didn't work. Some people can sew, some people can't. We ended up sewing a huge amount of badges back on every week. Some of them got stuck on. You know, it didn't work. I have tried every single trick in the book to make affordable.
Can I come in there again?
Yes.
You don't need a badge on a pair of football togs to let you know what you're playing for the Royal School in Armagh or the college in Armagh. You're playing your football and that's it, right? Maybe a shirt with a badge on it, but you don't need a black shoes to play basketball. You know?
Naomi,
this is nonsense.
I totally agree with William in terms of, you know, parents are absolutely bearing the brunt of this, and it really has to change. I think parent voice is really important to illustrate the hardships that parents are facing, and we really need to move away. The consultation was clear that people want the removal of compulsory PE branded kit. You know, the numbers in that are quite high, well, considerably high.
Well, we need
high,
to see the official numbers behind the consultation to wait to see what it was clear about. Paul in County Fermanagh, last call of the day. Morning, Paul.
Morning, Stephen. This thing about logos on shorts and stuff is a total farce, because I can go to a company there and can buy two T-shirts and get whatever logo I want on it for under £20. And they're good quality shorts of the same colour. There's no fading, there's no nothing. And I can't understand why schools aren't using outside companies like this that can supply They can supply a complete workforce. We'll say the district council or the education authority, they can supply a complete workforce with the same colour of T-shirts for two T-shirts with whatever logo you want on it for under £20. And yet now my daughter, who has two children, one at a Skilling College and one at the special care school, and the school uniform grant she gets is £70, doesn't even cover the shoes.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Obviously, this is a big discussion which we'll continue having. Kathleen, thank you. Naomi, thank you. Ellie Jo Taylor, thank you very much indeed. Thanks everyone for listening today. We'll see you, what day is this? Friday. I'll see you in 5 Live tonight. At 10 o'clock, I always realise I'm working on 5 Live on a Friday night when it comes to a Friday. And I remember I'm working tonight. See you Friday, Saturday, Sunday night and 5 Live back here Monday morning. Have a good weekend and thanks for listening.
In the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show!
Ho, 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 ho!